red letter N unfolds into a spectrum of colors.
Words appear. Powered by Fopop Media Incorporated, the definitive film logo appears. The opening sequence of the film, The Dark Crystal, appears. In a rocky landscape at night, dark clouds hang over a castle in the distance.
Another world, another time, in the age of wonder.
The opening sequence, which is just the most atmospheric, mythic, cool thing where, you know, the voiceover comes in all deep and low and talks about another age, and the age of wonder. And then you cut to these creatures, these monstrous, bird-like, reptilian figures.
Voice of Rian, Taron Egerton.
I just fell in love with it, and I've been in love with it ever since.
Publisher of The Dark Crystal Creation Myths, Stephen Christie.
The Dark Crystal is Jim's most human creation of everything that he did, which is a funny thing to say about a world where there are no humans.
I remember it vividly. I loved it. It's such an incredibly all-encompassing, vivid world. And the Skeksis are bloody scary.
It's the only part where I've known I was going to accept the part before opening the email. The original Jim Henson film, like all of Jim Henson's work, but especially that and Labyrinth, were huge parts of my childhood. I found them enchanting, the right side of dark for my sensibilities, and just completely otherworldly.
Co-executive producer and writer, Jeffrey Addis.
There was a book you could get at the library of The Making of the Dark Crystal. You couldn't find the book anywhere. This was kind of pre-internet. And I would just check that thing out, like, continuously.
Voice of the Chamberlain, Simon Pegg.
I just remember it being quite an overwhelming experience, you know. And everything about it, the visuals, the score. I love the score. Another one of those movies where you come out of the cinema slightly changed.
Netflix Vice President of Original Content, Cindy Holland.
Early memories I have of watching television with my father was The Muppet Show. It was one of the few television shows he would watch. And then he took me to see the Dark Crystal movie when it was in its theatrical run. And it was just something we'd never seen before. And it was so magical.
Dave Chapman.
Well, I left the movie theater going, well, how did any of that happen? I mean, I got Podlings. I sort of thought Podlings were a bit like Muppets. I get that. And then everything else, I just wanted to know how. But it's a game-changing film. So to go back and go, well, what can we do to match the level of script quality, art department, set design, everything?
With Dark Crystal, everything is built. Everything is made specifically just for us. It's based in reality. It's something tangible, something that doesn't trick the eye. And the craftsmanship, the talent that has been brought to the table, it's mind-blowing.
Vast on every level. I mean, it was one of the biggest things I think we've ever attempted in terms of the amount of characters, the sophistication of the characters, and also the challenge of recreating things that already exist.
What fans of The Dark Crystal want is they want an odyssey, they want a saga, they want something to enrich the universe of the original film, and that's what this series does. You could put them side by side and it is the same world, but there's just so much more of it to explore now.
Imagine if you are in the puppetry business, whether as a puppeteer or a puppet builder, what bigger opportunity is ever going to come your way than 10 episodes of Dark Crystal?
Shadowy images veiled in purple.
1,000 years ago, this land was green and good, until the crystal cracked.
There's so much here that you don't know about. There's an entire world to discover.
Words appear. Netflix presents a definitive film production. Title, The Crystal Calls, Making the Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance.
I was working in London for 5 years as a jobbing illustrator, and I needed to do my own work, but I didn't know exactly what that was. But once I got the opportunity to move to the country here, then immediately, the first thing I painted was indeed this picture of a troll with trees behind it and a waterfall coming off its nose. And that's what Jim saw. And I was a bit overcome, I think, meeting Jim, and I didn't know quite what to say or how to express myself, and it was his leap of faith.
My father really wanted to do an epic fantasy adventure. He really enjoyed doing comedy, he enjoyed doing Muppets, he loved Sesame Street, he loved this sort of fast, funny vignette kind of variety show, but he wanted to do something that really told a complex narrative.
But quite quickly, we were hiring people that had other skills. And Wendy was brought on board specifically for the Gelflings because Jim wanted that strong feminine thing.
Creative supervisor, Peter Brook.
It was all about bringing a character to life, all about creating something you've never seen before, that he was hoping the audience would not only believe in, but also scratch their heads and go, how do you do that?
Kira spreads her wings as she and Jen leap off a cliff.
You have Brian Froud, who is a guy who, for this world, these things are real. You have Frank Oz, who is one of the most brilliant puppeteers who's ever lived. And you have Jim bringing the world building and the humanity and the sense of human nature being put into these puppets. It's a brilliant kind of creative melting pot that brought the original thing to life.
Taron Egerton.
We live in an age of sequels and prequels, but the great thing about The Dark Crystal is it's such a microcosmic look at the world that when you finish watching it, you're left with these massive questions about the universe at large, which have never been answered.
Cheryl Henson.
And there are people who obsess about Dark Crystal, who really care about Dark Crystal. And over the years, it's really become a cult film.
Crew members carry puppets.
Is there going to be a feature film sequel? Is there going to be an animated TV show? I don't think that you could have done a new version of The Dark Crystal better than on Netflix with the right budget, with the creative team that Henson assembled. I mean, it's so exciting to see the world come back to life in that way.
Ted Biaselli, Netflix.
All too often, projects are rebooted or remade based on an IP where all the DNA of that thing that makes people love it is discarded. But for me, if you're going to remake or reboot a franchise, go back to why people like it in the first place.
Cindy Holland.
Teddy Biaselli had told me that Henson were interested in doing an animated series of The Dark Crystal, and I thought about it, and I went home and I watched the movie again. You know, I kept thinking about it. I was like, well, the mythology is great, but what makes it really special and transcendent is the puppets.
Ted Biaselli.
I picked up the phone. I was like, okay, good news, bad news. Bad news is we're not going to make The Dark Crystal animated series. The good news is Cindy wants to know what it would cost to do it live action. And you could hear the phone hit the floor.
And we were shocked. Like, really? A series that looks like the film? And of course, we immediately responded that it's, yes, like, it's technically possible, but it would be very expensive.
Cindy Holland.
The best version of The Dark Crystal that could be made today would be made by the Henson Company by giving them the freedom to really reach for the best version they can possibly imagine.
A scene from the Dark Crystal series. In a cave, a blonde, elf-like creature is flung to the floor by a bird-headed monster. Executive producer, Hallie Stanford.
And they picked up a teaser, a test, to see what it looked like.
Netflix could look at the test and see the same thing that we saw in it. So what we had tried to do in the test was we did CG Gelfling with puppet Skeksis.
Trespasser!
Does it make sense to do a TV show in the same way that they did the original film? You know, how much has technology progressed?
Gelfling hides behind a pillar.
What's that smell?
Ted Biaselli.
There's something disparate between a real tactile object that catches the light, that is layered and textured, versus something that is generated in a computer. And no matter how good it looks, they looked like two different mediums.
We could make a clean marriage between the two, and technically it could be done, but the CG Gelfling didn't look like Gelfling.
Rita Marie Perugi.
No matter what you did with the eyes of the puppet, those puppet glass eyes were so hard to replicate in a CG environment that you immediately could see that it was CG talking to the puppet, and then you really just wanted to see the puppet.
Seeing the test that they did before the shoot with full CGI character and a puppet, it's like night and day. It's amazing how much more evocative the puppet is.
As masterful as it is, you can't talk to a Pixar character in the real world. I mean, the percentage of the audience that gets to come and talk to a puppet in the real world is very small, but I think you know that you could.
We're going back to telling the story and what serves that, not just these effects are such fun, how much more effects can you do? How do the effects serve the story? What can they tell?
CG, they can expand your world, they can enhance it and augment it, and they can totally take it to places that just sets can't and just puppets can't. But they can't be the star of the show, and they shouldn't be the star of the show, because then you do lose that humanity and it does jar you out of it.
Ted Biaselli.
And we all looked around at each other and said, we're doing it all with puppets, guys. And Double Negative, the studio that did the CG, said, well, hold on, we want to show you something.
take just a shot from the movie and then just manipulate so you can add a little bit of blink or a little bit of smile and just take the performance from the puppet just that little bit further to add a bit more life to it.
And they augmented Kira's face a little bit that gave it a little bit more pop of life. And we all went, that's it.
Lisa Henson.
We as a company have been doing puppets for over 50 years. And to be here at this point, so many years later, and be doing what is got to be the biggest puppet production ever. This has no humans, so it is a complete puppet extravaganza.
Footage of a puppet waving a sword being filmed. A row of puppets from the series. Jeffrey Addis.
My writing partner and I came up with a pitch for a sequel to Labyrinth. And we called and we're like, there's these two guys, they have an idea for Labyrinth. Do you want to hear it for a sequel? And Henson Company was like, no, but we're doing Dark Crystal. And would you want to come in on that? And we're sitting there and all of a sudden this French gentleman comes in and says, hello, I'm Louis, I'm here to meet with Lisa.
And we realize we're pitching Lisa Henson and the guy who directed Hulk. And so we have to suddenly act like we know what we're doing.
Co-executive producer, Blanca Lister.
The way they pitched the idea of the show was just so perfect, and it was so engaging. It had high stakes, drama, intimacy, and of course great villains. So we were all really in awe, and our hearts were full of joy to see that we found the right person to bring this back to life again.
Carolina Garcia, Netflix.
The level of passion and excitement when they're telling a story had us engaged right away. So when they spoke the story to us, we were like all leaning in. We were like, what is this? What is this? And that transferred onto the page.
If you weren't incredibly familiar with the original film and didn't have a passion for it, it might be too hard to decide how to build up this very elaborate prequel.
Co-executive producer and writer, Javier Griot-Marchois.
We're looking at telling 10 hours of modern television, and it's 30 years after the original Dark Crystal came out. So we can't just live with the idea that we're introducing a new world. The world has existed for 30 years. So we had to break a lot of the narrative conceits of the film, a lot of the visual conceits of the film, and be free to do that.
And so you can't go into that with like, and here's how I do it. You gotta go in with like, okay, what do you like about what you're doing? What needs a little more life? What needs a little fleshing out? What's got too much fleshing out?
A photo of Jeffrey Addis and Will Matthews.
Jeff and Will, brilliant writers, never worked on television before in their life. We weren't about to literally throw them in the deep end without any sort of help.
So I go into the meeting and I'm ushered into Lisa Henson's office. And there's Lisa and Hallie and Blanca.
And he came in and he didn't know what he was there for. He was excited though. And we said, we're gonna show you something.
And then they show me this 5-minute trailer that they shot as a proof of concept. And the story has been told enough times that I'm not entirely sure what happened.
He was so excited and so happy. I think he man cried. I mean, I think he basically man cried.
I think on the outside, I was able to keep a pretty good poker face, but on the inside, I went out into like a full on ugly man cry for like my lost innocence and my childhood and for all the things I had loved as a kid. And I couldn't say no to the job. It was just one of those things where I was like, you could offer me a dollar. And I'm gonna do this job, you know?
The minute he walked in the room, you knew he was a huge fan of the property and he was a huge fan of process. He immediately set a tone of professionalism and nerd joy.
Overlapping triangles with circles at their points turn slowly. Voice of the Emperor, Jason Isaacs.
Are you nuts? Why would you remake something so great? And then I read the script. And then I saw they were making it into a TV series, and it was a prequel. I saw the people that were involved, and I thought, oh, I get it. You're really digging deep into the world, and you can do so many more things now.
Lisa Henson.
Louis came to us a long time ago because he wanted to know what we were doing with The Dark Crystal at the time we were developing a feature film. He jumped on board the feature film and worked with us on that development on how to do Dark Crystal for today. And he is the one person on the whole show who has the show in his head. He's incredibly thoughtful, and I feel like he's really the right person to be standing in my father's shoes from the original movie, where people can like ask him, all right, what are we doing here? You know, he's that person who knows.
Javier.
The Dark Crystal was heavy with the weight of legacy. Legacy because all of us grew up with Jim Henson. Legacy because The Dark Crystal was a huge movie for a lot of us who love cinema, and especially who love genre cinema. But the trick is to find that sweet spot where you still are able to be honest, you're still able to be respectful and you're still able to be creative.
Louis is not a writer, but he was in the writing room the whole time. So we did a writing room in Los Angeles with Jeff and Will and Javier and Jolie and Vivian. We had a nice team of writers. And then Louis worked with them even closer and, you know, rarely left the room.
Writer Vivian Lee.
Will and Jeff had already thought of the 10 episodes. So they did a lot of the heavy lifting for us. So we knew where we were going.
There was so much communication about where the canon was going and sort of what were important aspects to make sure that we didn't change or things that we did make sure that were the tentpoles.
Jolie is writing the YA books, and he's a big world creator. We've used a lot of what he developed in his YA books as texture and background for the story that the series tells.
Writing the novels, it was a lot about like making up place names and character names and environments. And now I'm just one piece in a very big picture.
Lisa Henson.
What was this incredible civilization that the Skeksis wiped out? That world building, which sort of occurred across the YA novels and across the graphic novels, you know, we kind of just created like that civilization, which is a matriarchal society. Seven clans, which are each run by their own Madra, who's the matriarch, and then all the Madras, the queen of all of them is the All-Madra, and she is of the Vapra clan. So we actually created seven different clans, which are not based on any human culture, but what they're a little bit based on is the way that human cultures are different from each other.
Certainly in science fiction and fantasy, you have realms whereby you can rehearse ideas that might not necessarily be possible in the real world. You can actually present power struggles or at least environments where things aren't necessarily dictated by the gender politics of the now here and show how changes can occur.
High fantasy, like all good storytelling, has a character story, has a plot story that drives the action. But the thing I think high fantasy can do probably better than any type of storytelling is it can send that bigger overall message, not only to bringing people into this wondrous new world, but also speaking to some issues right now that we all are feeling very strongly, and seeing it in myth, in a new myth, it's going to be very exciting.
It pulls on that idea of unity against an overriding darkness and evil.
All storytelling is about who we are, what we do, and how we behave, and what choices we make. And sometimes it's naturalistic, sometimes it's through a fantasy prism. But with this, when it's through creatures that don't look like us, from a world that is so far away from us, it makes us let our guard down. We don't notice that we're really talking about how human beings behave.
Javier.
What are the tentpole moments we have to hit? We know that the pilot is the Gelfling discover that the Skeksis are draining the Gelfling for their essence. So we know that's the inciting incident. You know, we know. So you start putting those tentpoles up on a whiteboard. And what that gives you is, it gives you, if not a roadmap, a set of destinations. And the creativity comes out of, you sit in a room, and this is how we did Lost also. You sit in a room day after day, and you go, okay, how do we get from point A to point B to point C to point D? And then the next thing you know, you have a season of television.
And from there, that's when you build a world. If you create a character such as, I'm going to use an example like Brea. So she's a princess, which means there's a mother who's a queen, which means, oh, there's a hierarchy, this legacy that she has. What's that landscape like? It's just a slow unravel, and it's very beautiful and it's very delicate.
We wanted to make sure that we also had a love story at its core, and it's the story of Rianne and Diet. And I think that these two characters need to meet and go on this journey together.
That's it! Monsters!
What?
Oh, I know exactly what to do now! You've been
Puppeteer Victor Yerid.
The language of podling was created by Joe Lee, who's one of our writers on the show, who had a background in linguistics. And he handed me a neat little vocabulary packet of all the podling and English words. And so I learned it by studying Joe Lee's diligent work.
Joe Lee.
He's done a huge amount to breathe life into it. He'll write me emails and podling, and I'm like, I don't know what that says. Like, I made up the language, but I'm not fluent in it.
Associate producer, Cameron Richardson.
So it's very inclusive for everyone. Every idea on this counts, like figuring out how is he going to shoot that arrow, because he also has four hands, so he can go like this. What if he also goes behind his head and shoots up in the air like that with those arms going up?
Javier.
At one point in the writer's room, somebody comes up with, hey, we should have a scene where podlings are being washed, and that just goes over there someplace. And then somebody says, we should send Brea to like some group of people who just do crap jobs and they're really unhappy. And then, you know, you give it to a talented writer like Vivian, and the next thing you know, the Daughtrin is going, the Deterge, and there's a season where you wash podlings? And by the way, that's also a good example of what I refer to as wide open spaces.
Footage of puppets being filmed. Simon Pegg.
Having written a Star Trek movie, I know what it's like when you write and such lands on such and such planet, and you know someone's going to have to go build that or design it or all of those things. But I think as a writer, you have to trust in the process. You can't think about the designers and the builders. They have to take care of themselves. You write whatever the heck you want to write, however vast and expansive it is, you just write it and let them tell you they can't do it. It's not your problem.
For Dark Crystal to be able to work, we had to have that full trust in the creative vision. I don't know where else you could make an epic action, adventure, fantasy, romance, story of love with puppets and have it be this epic.
Brian Wright.
The mantra is freedom and responsibility. People at all levels within Netflix do have a lot of freedom to do their jobs how they see fit, but you're accountable. So there's a responsibility for delivering at a really high level. And we extend that same mantra to our filmmakers.
On a cherry picker, an artist paints a huge forest mural on a backdrop, an image of ellipses intersecting at the center of a stylized sun. A special effects artist makes the head of a puppet. Taron Egerton.
Before I was an actor, the thing that really sort of set my soul on fire was drawing and sculpting and making characters, and that's sort of what I thought my life was going to be about. And I just remembered the first time that I opened the printout with the character breakdown and the little image that I just called, like, anyone who I thought might be interested to tell them about it, because it was just the coolest thing.
There's something to be said about the way something is moving in real space with the light catching it and that tactile sense, then bringing it to life.
Lisa Henson.
We were nervous about doing puppet Gelfling, and it came from my father's concern that the Gelfling hadn't been entirely successful in the first movie. The designs were beautiful. I mean, Wendy did an incredible job, but like the movement was not quite what he wanted.
They were sure that they were going to be able to do things that were far easier, far better. It wouldn't be difficult this time. They ran into the same problems because basically it's a hand in a very small head, and there isn't a lot you can do with that. You still need to have a lot of room for mechanisms up above and enough room for a hand to manipulate them out.
I think what's going to step up our new characters is how we were able to get the character into the eyes and into the skin texture.
We think the Gelflings are so much improved, it's almost hard to look back and remember why I was nervous about doing puppet Gelfling. But my father was nervous enough about it that he wanted to cast humans in Labyrinth.
A row of Gelfling puppets. Animatronics supervisor, John Criswell.
But don't get me wrong, the original stuff is magical in its own right. You know, back then they would carve out fingers out of wood. Now we 3D printed fingers out of plastic.
It's really, the design is fundamentally based on what we know they built on the original movie, which is basically this skull, your partial skull, with the teeth mounted kind of below it on a wire.
And you think it's not bad, but a puppeteer has to have it on their hand for hours.
The skins are foam latex, as they were on the original, which is a very light and flexible material.
This is the core, and this is the actual detail itself inside.
Robin Schoonrad.
So we've got two moulds going on here in theory. So this is the core mould, which we get our fiberglass outside that goes inside it for the animatronics, and inside here is the detail.
The inside,
Jasper Anderson,
of the skin is actually exactly the same shape as the outside of the skull.
So I cut this character in half right there, and what that does is it allows me to make a tray. And from that tray, I just start building off.
So this is the main hero Augra puppet that Kevin uses most often. But this is sort of its clone. She has a foam latex skin like the original did. And then inside, she ends up with her ugly Augra teeth and a foam mouth a lot like that one. So he grips it like this.
A puppeteer operates the puppet.
and is able to make her talk that way. But then there's a radio control that gives a second puppeteer expression over her eyebrows and her eye.
Costume designer Wendy Froud.
Technology is great. There are a lot of things that you can do now that you couldn't do then. But when it comes right down to it, it's still basically a hand in a head.
Using his hand, a puppeteer operates the head of the hero Agra puppet. Creature and costume designer Brian Froud sits at a desk, sketching creatures on paper.
You know, when I do it, it's just a drawing, it's a few scribbles. They got to sculpt it, and it's in clay, and it's a dead thing, and you've got to make sure that somehow that has life. Then it's made into a mold, which is a dead, dead thing, and then it's cast into this strange thing that is rubber, that has its own life, but has nothing to do with what you're doing. And then you've got somebody who's going to make mechanics in it that are just solid and only do a few things. And you've got to try and get those things together. And it's got to now express some life. And then you give it to the puppeteer.
A puppeteer slowly lifts a Gelfling puppet off a stand. Creative director Jim Henson's Creature Shop, Peter Brook.
It's another challenge for a show like this is that we're creating the actors for the show. They're not gags. They're not seen only from the left side or the right side, or, you know, they don't just show up for 5 minutes. This is the cast.
I'll wait.
A puppeteer taps a puppet hand on a clapboard.
Ready? Clap test.
Puppeteer Neil Sterenberg.
I don't think puppeteers aren't well known by nature of their job, that they are hidden. And I don't think there's very few famous puppeteers. It is an art where you choose to hide. And I very much think it's like a musician, that you have an instrument, but you play a beautiful tune on it, but we all listen to the tune. It's the tune we remember. It's not necessarily the piano it was played on. It's the character that lives and has its own life.
People were telling stories with puppetry long before they decided to come up and act, because they were too frightened to act, because they were trying to represent all the ancient gods and all the myths. We're just bringing back, with the current technologies and sort of mythology, that we've got this desire to explore these different storylines, but we're just being able to do it through Netflix and through animatronics.
When we fail our emperor...
As a child, I endlessly drew Jim Henson content and Star Wars content. Drawings, at least to write stuff and model stuff in plasticine. I was obsessive about both those things, and I've been very blessed, very lucky.
3, 2, 1...
Puppeteer Warwick Brownlow Pike.
At the age of 2, I saw puppets on television for the first time, and I was like, I need to do that. Straight away, I was like, that's what I want to do for life. And I did it from that point on.
My dad gave me a book when I was growing up, and this book was Fairies, and it was illustrated by Brian Froud.
All the work that I've ever seen Henson's do has informed what I do now, and strangely, full circle, here I am doing what inspired me at the beginning.
Simon Pegg.
The point is, with puppetry, is that it's a medium, it's an art form in itself, and that's what you're watching. It helps you to stay slightly detached and think about it a bit more. You don't just get hypnotized by looking through a window. You know, you're looking at something which is a representation.
Series footage of Rian sharpening a sword, then holding it up and staring wide-eyed at it. Senior costume and creative supervisor, Toby Froud.
This is one of our first rehearsals for the puppet show. It's the puppet show that the Heretic and the Wanderer in the Circle of the Suns are going to do for the Gelflings, to basically show them the way, show them what needs to be done, what should happen, and how the world of Thra should be in this crazy little puppet show. We have this great young puppeteer called Barnaby Dixon, who does YouTube puppets with his fingers.
Inner Sun, it carries the spirit of Thra. And, when wielded by Gelfling, holds the power to unite the seven clans and defeat the Skeksis.
Victor Yerid.
When I teach puppetry, I always tell people there are three main elements. Manipulation of the puppet, voices, and your acting. And of the three, the acting is by far the most important. When someone's a strong actor like Becky is, it comes through.
Becky Henderson.
The first few scenes that I did with Dee, I was still freaking out a lot. But the first scene that I did with Dee and Huck, I was way more relaxed, and it was nice to have somebody else there.
Despite being fantasy characters, majority of them, particularly the girlfriend, we've got to bring this naturalism to them to engage with the drama of everything.
And it's got to be believable. I mean, it's not like you've even got two nice, colourful characters just against the white backdrop and you're enthralled by them. This is a whole universe.
Cameron Richardson.
You know how hard it is to hold your hand up like this, even for 5 minutes? And they're doing it with, you know, 20, 30 pounds on top of it, and then acting emotionally, and, you know, you take on the emotions of the character that you're playing. It's intense.
When I read these scripts, I thought, my God, the acting skills required. This is not just funny Muppety. To come to this, we had to learn another language because the Gelflings particularly require stillness, precision, subtlety.
Sharon Egerton.
You indulge in an illusion. Everyone, apart from the youngest members of the audience, know that they're looking at an inanimate object. But through a collection of great performers and great makers, the audience are able to invest in this thing and believe that it's real life. And there's something really magic about that.
Jason Isaacs.
Well, to bring these characters to life, the first thing you do is look at them because they're already created. Unlike when you're acting on screen and you choose your costume or the way you walk or move, there's the way that they look. And then there's a huge part of it that is dictated by the puppeteer. They decide when the character's suddenly shouting aggressive or whether they look like they're taken aback by something. And so the performance really takes place within certain parameters that are shaped a lot by the puppeteer, which is why Louis's been working with them as actors.
I have to eventually come to the point with every character where I can make faces without thinking. I think happy and my hand just does it. As I'm showing you this, she's thinking. She's emoting. She's, you know, she can be scared. She can be thoughtful. She can be sad.
Puppeteer Alice Dinian operates her puppet, Victor Yerid.
Someone else is doing your eyes, and you have a sad moment where you close the eyes. And then when you come out of it, either they have to kind of catch it when you come up, or maybe they come out early and that forces you to come up. But because I'm controlling it, it all feels real, and the timing feels real.
With a Muppet, you're so used to going like that. Now, on these things, that doesn't quite look right. It looks like he's riding a horse to Banbury Cross. But it is just the movement translating from your own walk with a bit of something in it to make him work. And just keeping them alive. I found when I'm performing Rian, it's almost like I can't let him keep still. I have to, while I'm with him, I just have to sort of just change the weight of where he's standing.
I'm not afraid.
Naturally, when she looks around, the shoulders kind of go with her, but I don't think that looks very natural. So if I have an assist, I'll get them to do both hands and I'll hold her body still.
Puppets are funny because they can kind of do nothing, but make you believe they're doing everything. So like just a tilt of the head and you read an emotion, like a down is sad, for instance. So it's just playing with the camera and the light and the positioning, and you can really sell any emotion.
It's really difficult and exacting, and it's very precise. And so where they get a moment where your whole job is to, like, be a half-naked podling running through the forest, they're like, then I'm gonna go all the way with that.
Footage of puppeteers operating their puppets on set. Puppeteer Kevin Clash.
And we're probably gonna be in the suits for a great deal of time today because it's a long scene. So this is a challenging one.
We clamber in here alongside them, quite snuggly, and I rest my head in Warwick's armpit.
Well, the Skeksis are body suits. It's like a rucksack. They're sort of harnessing it on you. Then our hands go up through the head, and we're operating like this.
I think what I'll do is just sit up. Hi. Hi, I'm in the Skeksis. Isn't that fun? It's very dark and sweaty in here. Yay.
So this is the Chamberlain's body. It looks quite small, but actually it's bigger than they originally were in the movie. Or so we're told. Louise Gold knows this because she was there for both the movie and for this series.
We also have a monitor, a small monitor strapped to us, because as puppeteers, and in Jim's way of working, we're seeing exactly what the camera sees. So we're in some way directing. We can see exactly what we're doing.
We have these shoulder straps, and then in the belly of the beast, we have our monitor.
Ollie Taylor.
We're watching two shots simultaneously
and pretty much most of the time a third camera, which is like a CCTV.
This is Jürgen.
Jürgen?
Tight sweet.
It is.
Becky and an assistant help Warwick into a huge puppet.
So there are a series of buckles.
There's a waistband.
All right, you good?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay, you got the way?
That's me, I'm in.
Gerard will put the head on. Takes a village to get a sketches on. And I'll put my hand up in here.
Thank you very much, Jürgen. I'm sure that's fine.
No, one thing.
No, one more thing. What?
Open wide.
Ah!
The assistant sprays water into the puppet's beak-like mouth.
There you go.
Tasty.
Working a sketch is extremely hard. It's the hardest puppet I've ever performed in my entire career. But then it's really freeing, because once you're inside that puppet, you just can't be seen from head to toe. You're invisible, and that character lives.
Particularly when you have such a skilled puppeteer as Warwick, who do all those little head moves and stuff, and you can see how he's talking when you're watching the playback. I've got a lot of help from all over the place. Yeah, Warwick's interpretation, his movements, the incredible sort of visuals that I'm looking at.
I was certainly trying to follow on from Frank's performance in the movie and get that kind of sleazy, snaky, fluid movement. It's a really distinct performance.
This is good, yes. Emperor will be most pleased. I go now. Bye-bye.
Wait!
Yes?
Cryptic symbols are superimposed over a black and white image of the Chamberlain. An Open magazine features an article entitled Brian Froud, Creating the World of the Dark Crystal. Drawings and creatures appear in a notebook. Lisa Henson.
Everything is designed to fit in Brian Froud's aesthetic. And if he didn't design it himself, he's weighed in on everything himself. And he did design every puppet character and every costume.
A suit of armor in Brian's studio.
That's where it all begins. It starts with Brian's line, the pencil line that he draws on the page, the curve that he'll use.
At a desk, Brian Froud sketches a creature.
In the lines I draw, there's something about them that encapsulates life. You know, there's a line and it might have a flow to it and it feels all right, but we're going to have to turn this into three dimensions. We're going to have to get somebody to sculpt this, and they're going to have to put in the wrinkles, and they can't just put in wrinkles any way they like. It's trying to get people to understand is, you are going to sculpt these wrinkles in this character because they have to have a meaning. All the wrinkles, there is no superfluous wrinkles. What is the character of this thing? It tells you something about it, and so they have to listen to not my drawings anymore, but actually what the character is that you're trying to reach.
Toby Froud.
For him to come and revisit this world and get back into it might have been a challenge, but a rewarding one.
I don't picture things in my head. Can't do it. I can't picture it in the head and then just draw it. To get to my subconscious, to get rid of the chattering mind, I'll just scribble. And it's like looking at nature and trying to see a face in the bark of a tree. Somewhere in here, I've got to find what that is. The challenge is, it's got to be different, but it's got to be meaningful. How do you find meaning in a line?
Be able to see that stuff come out and see those things work and characters come alive once again, or to be able to talk to him and find out, you know, about things from the original or how he interprets something or sees something. I mean, that's the magic.
Jeffrey Addis.
I think it's amazing that the whole Froud family has kind of come back. Like, to see the three of them working together is incredible, and to see him watch his son follow in sort of the family business, but it's not even the family business, it's like the family world.
That's where I think we're sort of thriving in this fact, is the fact that we're you know, we're in this world that's so natural to us as a family that we're able to just impart what we know or what we actually just know to be real. As I grew older, I found that I had the Froudian style, as we call it, where it felt comfortable and it felt like home.
I went into the creature workshop and it's still the Frouds who are creating these wonderful otherworldly creations. And he's Brian Froud's son who is doing a lot of the work in there. And I was like a fanboy meeting him because he's the baby from Labyrinth. So then the duality of not only seeing someone from a film that I loved as a child, but then also seeing his creative prowess and this incredible work he's doing. It was just fantastic to go and get a glimpse of all that.
You have to take something that's spiritual and creative and beautiful to look at, i.e. Brian's designs, and then somehow translate them and actually create a puppet that works, a sculpture that is going to work technically, mechanically for the puppeteer, as well as visually look correct and capture the spirit that was in Brian's drawings.
Costume supervisor Julie Zabel.
Generally, we get one of two versions of designs when we have designers. It's either maquettes are the small sculptures, and Toby Froud was providing those. And those are very helpful because you get a three-dimensional view of what you're creating. And Brian Froud was sending sketches, and he's got a very loose style. So luckily for us, Toby Froud is with us, and he's known his father his whole life. Imagine. So he could interpret what the squiggles meant.
What they were doing is very kindly trying to tidy my drawings up. They were trying to even everything up. And once they understood it's meant to be asymmetrical, it's meant to be growing and organic and have a flow to it, it just became simple and it just, everything fell into place from then on. Yeah.
Sometimes we weren't understanding exactly the direction design-wise, we weren't hitting it. And then he said, that's it. What I want is other.
Toby Froud.
Again, it's that journey. It's just believing and trusting. And as soon as it happens, you'll get on. And then it just moves.
The process of designing something like this does start with looking back at the old film, obviously. That's what you're trying to reproduce, that spirit, and push it further. And obviously, Brian Froud was very much with Jim Henson, the architect of that early product. And Brian is still around, you know, he's been quite involved, and we were all a bit nervous at the beginning of obviously meeting him and talking to him, knowing that we were sort of holding his baby.
Jim really was intrigued by ley lines, and then there was sacred geometry. And what it did was give the original film a depth.
We made sure that both in the script, but also in the art department production, that all those symbols and all that language, that it had layers and that it had, therefore, life.
Brian has done some wonderful drawings from the Skeksis, and you'll see just little kind of bug-like creatures, you know, on these circles and triangles and everything. And I took those, and from them I sketched in the end we ended up with about 54 symbols from which we said, okay, this is our Skeksis alphabet. And so we eventually made it to here, which is this is the aggression symbol, which is the big Skeksis symbol. And then it opens. It's a very aggressive object. So you try and read some of this, and then it just springs open.
Hallie Stanford.
To put together a fantasy universe on paper is a lot of work, but then to do the details of the fantasy world practically, first of all, it's fun, but it's a lot of work. The artistry of it's huge.
First thing happens, I came in and met Louis, and I looked at the screen and they ran a bit, and I was taken aback. I was just sideswiped by the scale and majesty of it, how it looked like a gigantic Hollywood special effects movie. I hadn't expected, I guess, that level of effort and artistry. I had no idea of the kind of epic nature of the show.
Well, rocks to create a little bit of a gate for the ramp.
No, that'll work well.
Cryptic symbols appear superimposed over the animatronic interior of a puppet's head. Director of photography, Eric Alexander Wilson.
I just feel like it's such a luxury to be allowed to shoot in this world that's not only so rich and full of details, but that is, of course, just handmade from scratch for this.
Often when you watch a film or you watch a special effects movie, you'd say, how do they do that? With this, you know how they do it. It's just incredible how they do it.
They had about 30 to 35 sets on Dark Crystal, and they had about 3 years prep. We have about 70, 80 sets, and we had about 6 months prep. So your first, other than creative thoughts, is about a schedule, is about how do we work this?
We were prepping this from when we started pre-production, making the trees, the plants, the vines that are hanging up, and then there's all the prop-make plants that we based most of them from the original movie, so we've got all the old photos and reference of all those crazy little plants that were in Dark Crystal.
Every piece that you've seen here, we've actually copied from the original film. We actually got the original drawings.
The original drawings, yeah, original photographs, concept, even the original concept models of the original sculpts.
Richard and Ty jumped into the Froud sensibility very, like, they went in feet first.
I mean, that there's an original Skeksis sword, when this is actually copied from the original one. I mean, they're beautiful. You know, it's obviously Brian Froud designed those.
Artists sculpt props and set pieces. Taron Egerton.
There's a real joy in knowing that every detail has been completely lovingly crafted, and there's something akin to a great painting. There's something wonderful about knowing you can pause any frame and know that no moment in there is an accident. Every leaf you see has been placed there, every movement of the character has been considered.
To invest in creating an entire other world, down to the smallest details of what its flowers look like and its foodstuffs, to the constellation of the planetary alignments of the cosmos that it holds, you are transported to an entirely different landscape, which overwhelms you.
Will Matthews.
I turned to Jeff at one point and said, boy, we better be careful what we write. Because, you know, we just put, like, the exterior balcony. And then we get into, what are they talking about on the balcony? What's the plot? What's the story? What are the characters on the balcony? And then you look, and this balcony wraps around, and it's 300 feet long, and you're just like, who thought of it? It's beautiful.
One of the big ones was the Citadel, the throne room for the Harar Gelfling clan, and completely new world, very important. It's the head clan. We went through quite a few different incarnations of what that needed to be, trying to hold it within the budget, because anything with a compound curve that isn't a straight line is more expensive than something with a straight line.
We had Machu Picchu, which was our inspiration for this. This was a town that was up in the heavens.
Thatched roof huts made of curving stone. Simon Pegg.
Well, it was fantastic to see those environments practically, not framed for the camera, because you could see the mechanics of it. The fact that they had to be built so high so that the puppets could go inside.
So our standard height here, we have 4-foot-high rostrums. That is the finished set floor, and then the set sits on top. And that's so we can open up the floor to drop the puppeteers in to have the creatures at the right height. That doesn't happen on a normal show. So you've got the creature's complexity, you've got the complexity of the set, so you have to map out in great detail which creature's going to move where to provide the right type of flooring or open up the flooring.
Set decorator Richard Roberts.
On another film where you're not making everything, I'll run around and find everything, book it from the rental companies and buy it, and then... But with this, it's on a daily basis, we're constantly making pieces.
And not just at human scale. There's nothing that could be really hired or purchased.
Sculpting's been our biggest thing on this. I mean, literally everything you see has been sculpted. I mean, we concepted this, and it's very Froudian, as you can see. I mean, it's beautiful.
With, like, any piece of art, you can keep going and going and going. You have to just say, that's your time, this is where we've got to be, and plan that, those 5 weeks, of where each week they want to be at. From archives, original photographs, we're able to scale up, draw off, and take all the information off the original and get it as close as we possibly can.
And the reason there's this massive hole here is for the puppeteer, obviously, to work the puppet. So.
Purely a fiberglass piece, polyester resin, and then we're having to, again, down to the painters now to do the finishing, and then onto set, and that's the continuing train of work.
A set decorator at work.
Everybody came together for the common good, and Gavin, the production designer, was amazing. And him and his team, they produced the most gorgeous sets I think I've seen ever.
A masonwork passageway, dangling, glowing, multicolored, translucent pods. Lush strings of vegetation dangle from rocks. Set directors build a set. Javier Griot-Marchaud.
When you put something on a page, more than 100 people are going to come to work on the show and create that thing.
more so in The Dark Crystal, because it is a completely synthetic universe. Everything that we write has to be made by somebody, and it's by hand.
It's pushing that back into a handmade quality and feel, and it's the hardest thing to do. The film was so rich and vibrant in every single frame, and to do that across a TV show is a huge problem.
You know, when you look at every little detail in The Dark Crystal, you look at the books in that library, you look at the vials in the scientist's chamber, those things are the apex of somebody's art.
You're looking at a set that's all styrofoam, but it looks like parquet wood, it looks like stone, it looks like marble, because the painting is so incredible. And at the same time, in the creature shop, we have people who are putting in individual hairs. The land strider has hair all over its body. Everyone was hand-punched.
The main kind of color of hair around here is just one pattern piece, and then we've gone through it and put other types of fur through it to kind of break it up a little bit. But the pattern had a direction on it so that we kind of have it sticking up as much as possible, like the original one. So you use like a beading needle that's filed down, and then there's one edge to it, so it picks up like a few hairs at a time to keep it quite natural, I guess.
Well, this is Bria's journal, and Bria is one of our main characters. And this is kind of her prized possession. I think it represents her. The idea that it's a beautifully embroidered item that maybe her grandmother embroidered for her. The paper is handmade, you know, it's very beautiful. But I thought it was extremely important that this was a real object. So I sat down for quite a few days and just painted and painted. So just putting key things in, like our mother augur, and also taking actual flower pressing. You know, the idea of things getting a little bit purple, a little bit the darkening's coming in a little bit into her world.
The Hup's going to have a spoon, or Hup's going to have a couple different versions of a spoon, and those are handcrafted and made, and we sit and have meetings about, like, the size of the spoon, and at one point he was going to have a whisk, and did that sort of drift away from the spirit of Hup? Like, he's really all about spoons, it shouldn't be a whisk. But people made a whisk, and we looked at the whisk, and it was designed, and you're like, I don't think this is Hup, I think he's a spoon.
And you write something like, the podling, he doesn't want a bath. Anyway, moving on. And they're like, okay, we got a village, there's 30 podling, they don't want a bath, but each of them doesn't want a bath in a different way. So we made all these podlings, and you're just like, okay, that's exactly what I meant.
Jeffrey Addis.
Like, we looked at podling butts. Sculpts. Does that make sense? And the first one, we were like, that's not right. And had it redone. And so we, like, there was multiple sculpts of podling posteriors before we got to the one that I think you'll see in the show.
It meant something to everybody, you know. And you could feel that on the set. Everybody was so at pains to make it Dark Crystal. It was a puppet show. And a puppet show is an art. And that art is a big part of the thing itself.
Cryptic symbols appear over footage of artists sculpting props. Multiple puppeteers operate a huge spider-like puppet. Taron Egerton.
We're still riveted and amazed by CG, but there is so much of it that I think there is an element of kind of desensitizing that happens. The wonderful thing about this world is everything has weight. It's real, it has texture. If you were in front of the camera, you could reach out and grab them. And I think that's really exciting too, the reality of it, the weight of it.
Peter Brook.
Jim would have embraced every tool in the box available to him. And I have no doubt that he would have absolutely loved CG and what CG would have allowed him to do.
My father was a real innovator when it comes to all different kinds of aspects of puppets on television, puppets on film. And he had to invent all the time. He had to come up with new ways of doing things.
Footage of a Gelfling flying.
Oh, hi, family!
We didn't want to just rely on the fact that CG could potentially fix the problem or could even substitute a digital character for a practical character. We wanted to make sure that everything that we did and all the shots could be covered practically.
Lisa Henson.
We've been talking for a long time about using more puppeteer removal so that you can do a large character by controlling from the outside and then removing the puppeteers and the rods.
Actually, the guys in DNAG are doing some interesting tests for some of the CG shots that they have to do, where they've built a human figure behind the CG rig. and it'll be articulated from the human figure behind it. So it kind of mimics all the kind of the inaccuracies and all that kind of thing, so it doesn't become too smooth.
You could get motion capture directly onto that, so then you're literally replicating the performance through the puppeteer. Anything that gets us as close as possible to the methods that the puppeteers are using.
Law is a character that was originally decided to be a full CG character because of the way he's articulated and what he's made of and the things he has to do in the script.
We had so many meetings about the look of Law. I mean, this thing evolved. And at one point he had, you know, three legs. One point he looked like a giant turtle. One point he was just a big block. I mean, there were so many looks of Law. And now we've come to this thing where it looks like a pile of stones and it looked like they were going to fall. And he says, I think there's a Law in this.
The more we started to work on it, the more people got thinking about it, and we did animation tests, and that got the puppeteers excited, and then it became this thing where they're like, well, you know, we can build a puppet that can do way more than we thought and gives Louis even more on set and more in camera.
We thought we had set this challenge that you couldn't do, and then they did it, and so Law is on set, and Law is there, and Law is puppeteered, and it's beautiful to see them interact and come together.
Well, Law's got this really nice, sort of like layers of rock. And emotionally, when Damo moves the hair, just trying to keep it sympathetic with what he's doing and what he's observing, because it looks like a mouth, but this is really where he's seeing through, isn't it?
He can be down quite low, and then he can be up quite high. So we know that there are kind of key positions that he will always go to, you know?
Three puppeteers operate Law with poles. Ted Biaselli.
Never in my dreams would I think that that thing would be so cool. But man, I can't wait to own a Law figure.
It's nice to see the CG technology used collaboratively with the puppets. The whole thing feels very true to the Dark Crystal. It is first and foremost a puppet-led thing. But there are tiny little things you can do. Like in the original film, not that it mattered and not that I cared and not that it was ever a thing, but occasionally you can see a rod now and again, you know? Not that that means, oh, wait a minute, there's a rod, it's not real. Of course you know it's not real, it's a puppet show. You should be able to see all the rods, really. But what they can do now is they can remove that stuff, add blinks, add little bits and bobs which give them a little bit more life and presence and just help with the magic trick that it is.
The way it's developed, even the effects that are CG effects, we've now complemented most of those by realizing them in a dual capacity where we have the puppet version of it and the CG version of it. So there's almost nothing in the whole series that exists only as a CG effect.
And it's still photoreal, so in some ways the techniques are still the same. We're still replicating the real world, it's just that the real world is Thra. It's Jim Henson's, it's Brian Froud's. And I think there's something about the tangible, handcrafted quality of it all that immediately makes people think, well, actually, this isn't like anything we've done before, so we do need to think differently about it.
The plan now is for the CG to be more based on the rigging and have all these little flaws in it that the puppets have.
VFX supervisor, DNEG, Andy Hargraves.
For me, it should always be, you know, it's not just for the art department to try and work this out, because maybe the VFX guys can do it better. It's not just for the VFX guys to do it, because actually, if you built it, it would be better. You know, no one should be too precious about what they're doing.
Scenes of puppets before a green screen, interspersed with the CG background behind them. Cryptic symbols superimposed over a puppeteer manipulating a puppet's controls. Taron Egerton.
The great thing about voice work is that it's inherently a collaborative process. And you are far from the most important cog in the machine.
They have made choices in movement, in pace, in style. They've made characterization choices that you inherit.
It's a very interesting process, and it's been very, very challenging in a good way, because usually when you do a voice in something, if you do animation, you do the voice, and then the animators take your voice and they animate to the voice. With this, it's the other way around. You have to match your performance to the puppeteers, who are all very good at what they do. They are actors, you know, they characterize, but you have to match their mouth flaps.
It's an interesting discipline because the puppeteers, the world's greatest puppeteers, have done the work already. And so you have to act and convey truth, power, fear, threat, whatever it is, but you have to match the discipline.
The crystal calls to the crystal chamber. Scroll keeper. Scrollkeeper!
We take a lot of time to get it right, because you can be satisfied that you match the movement and sync, but you're trying to give performances that are as real and as engaging as possible.
Simon Pegg in a studio.
Go? Leave? No, no, no. Chamberlain will decide when Grunach's service is finished.
Until then, Grunek, stay right where are. Mm-hmm.
So that's actually quite hard sometimes when you might choose a different way of delivering a line, but you've got to get it into this rhythm of speech. It is amazing to be part of that group of Skeksis.
From there, so she hits him. So first, like, she told you to let go. She told you to let go. Okay? And there's something
told you to let
hard
go.
About it. It's really difficult, but the reward is even greater because it's tangible. It feels tactile.
It's also key that you create a sense of spontaneity in it, and immediacy, and life.
We protect the Lords. The Lords protect the crystal of truth.
The ensemble cast of actors that are doing the voice work speaks for itself. It's incredible, but behind that is the other layers of the puppeteers and the suit artists. And it's a team effort, like it's genuinely a team effort.
It's a huge variety of people in this from different countries and cultures, and I think you'll get a sense of that. You'll get a sense of a big eclectic world.
Superimposed over a huge purple crystal held aloft by metal pinchers, the title, Jim Henson's The Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance appears. Composer Daniel Pemberton.
So this is when we see the crystal. So when the crystal comes down, we get this sound that we've come to associate with the crystal. And there's an instability to the sound. This is kind of connected to the crystal and the Skeksis, in a way. It's a very uncomfortable sound. So this creates, again, a sound you wouldn't associate with an orchestra. It's just a very unusual sound.
Series footage of the Chamberlain operating an elaborate machine that raises and lowers the crystal. Electricity flashes.
The Dark Crystal world has always felt to me like from a different time. I sort of felt musically I wanted to incorporate as many different elements from all types of musical culture into the score. I also wanted to give it a simplicity in a way, because a lot of early instruments, they might not even have a chromatic scale. They might have quite a simple scale on them. And by limiting yourself to more of just a smaller range of notes, it starts to feel hopefully more authentic. So I want it to feel like this music could have been made in flat.
Cast him out! How can they not? To believe him is not to believe themselves.
On a cliff, a family of Gelflings hug. Daniel Pemberton plays a keyboard.
And so the idea with that is we can use it in lots of different ways through the show.
Thra belongs to us now. And is nothing, nothing Gelfling can do.
Series footage of a Gelfling rising up out of a hole towards sunlight.
The first times we were going around set, we would just find all these like mad objects and we're like, oh wow, like you could just, it was so tactile. And I think that's a really important word in this. If the music can feel as tactile as everything else, then we've sort of succeeded.
Footage of puppeteers making podling puppets dance on set.
I think everyone involved in this show has put so much work and effort into every minute detail. And I think every department from, you know, sound to costume design to story to set building, the puppeteers, everyone is putting something that most of us wouldn't even know what is going into it. And that's what makes the show so special, I think, because it's creatively, like, kind of unlike anything else you've seen.
A map of the Dark Crystal world appears superimposed over two of the bird-headed creatures. Jason Isaacs.
Nobody's making films with puppets anymore, and these are the world's greatest puppeteers, but they're working at the very top of their game. They're working in a context where one of the greatest DPs in the world is lighting it and shooting it. And so it's a look that you've never seen before. It's a look I've never seen before, that's for sure.
Go away, I can see you. I'll be on the other side.
Filmmaking of all types is deceptively simple. That's the thing about it, you know, it's an illusion. And that's the great joy of it, you know, that there's a bunch of people working painstakingly and lovingly to create something that other people enjoy in a fraction of the time it took to create.
On set, a camera operator adjusts his equipment. Peter Brook.
Louis was just fantastic. I mean, I don't know how he does it. He almost immediately got how a movie like this is made. I really loved the fact that he embraced our methodology so wholeheartedly. I felt he was always, you know, behind us. He was championing what we were doing.
First assistant director, Ollie Robinson.
Absolutely, every day is a voyage of discovery on this job. We anticipate, analyze, and plan as best we can, but the sequences are big, they're ambitious, you can't cover all your bases, and then obviously you get on set, things change, like the shot changes. Something's not working quite right, so we're always discovering better ways, newer ways to achieve what we set out to. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes things don't work as we planned, and then we have to completely change direction.
We're constantly altering and changing and addressing everything. We're replacing skins and we're fixing mouth interiors. We're working on hand paddles. We're trying to always make things better and also make sure that things function for whatever they need to do next.
The beauty of it is it looks simple. At the end of the day, nobody's going to understand what it took to try to get there.
If you'd have said, let's shoot puppets handheld and Steadicam with two cameras simultaneously, I'd have said, you're crazy.
It's counterintuitive. You need to hide the puppeteer's head and you need to hide the sleeves. And as soon as you have a wobbly frame, then you're just going to kill yourself. But, you know, he does it and he does it amazingly. I think it will change the way people perhaps shoot puppets in the future.
Jeffrey Addis.
Louis strapped into that rig. He's moving on the fly. He's constantly adjusting. Okay, there's a head coming in here, or there's here and there's that. And so it's much more sort of fluid. And so the puppeteers have, I don't think any of them had ever worked with having two cameras running, which means two monitors. And eye lines can get tricky with puppets.
We're quite used to quite static stuff on us. And we kind of work within a frame that we're given. Whereas Louis and Eric, that they're giving us so much movement, and we know Louis's got a much bigger picture in his head than we have.
Louis Leterrier.
The best, the idea is that...
Laura, let me know when we're all lined up.
You watch the show, and you forget you're watching puppets. And if we do this, if we achieve that, it might be onto something. Ah, no, we did it. But we're trying. Every day we try.
Voice of Onika, Natalie Dormer.
It's a marathon task. It's to have the mental capacity to play that three-dimensional chess of being thinking about pre-production, shooting, post-production, all the different elements that something like Age of Resistance requires.
And he's also incredibly laid back and mellow. And I think for most people, the task of bringing something like this to life, it's quite hard to comprehend the amount of work that goes into this that you don't see.
Lisa Henson.
I think what we've never done is this kind of dance between the camera and the puppets. So Louis moving the camera through, not necessarily always telling people where the camera's going to be, and then having the characters be able to interact with a moving camera. There's so much more dynamism to this shooting that I think that is the first.
I love it, the energy it gives it. You can really start to use it when you know he's coming round and then you can turn into his shot.
He's directing through something, you know, he's directing through the puppet to the puppeteer, which can't be easy, giving performance notes to the people underneath, which has to then be telegraphed above.
We're doing everything we can to make sure that the characters can run and jump and fly and climb and do a lot more action than they could originally.
On-set footage of puppeteers operating puppets interspersed with footage that includes CG background. Natalie Dormer.
The physical strength that is required to be there on set holding a camera every day, as well as the mental. What Louis has done is superhuman, but to the benefit, because it means that the audience innately feel his energy, and there will be a house style. There will be a house energy.
Cameron Richardson.
It makes it a lot easier to have somebody that has full knowledge of every single episode and every item that goes in that episode. And even still, it's just so overwhelming. There's so much minutia that goes into this.
And three!
Absolutely, this is Louis' show. He drives it and he runs it, and everyone kind of fills in behind him and helps create his vision.
Well, the performers will come and would raid the village, you know, so two by two coming around, and then we have all of them gathering, so that's 18, 19. I want to use those big swords in the beginning. I think he would go for like... And he goes... And he's going to
Puppeteers rehearse a sword fight.
General's going to push. And then Rian goes, oh, fuck, like that. And the thing just goes like this, gets stuck.
Series footage of the general driving his sword towards Rian, who scurries away backward. The general slips his sword between Rian's legs and flips him onto his feet. Rian drives his sword into the general's stomach.
It was never in my wildest dreams that Louis Leterrier was going to direct all 10 episodes. It's inhuman, by the way.
The biggest question when a director's going to take that kind of...
Rita Marie Peruggi.
...amount of work on, you think, wow, that's nuts. But the beauty of it is it's a single vision.
It's quite tough, and I'm just shooting it. Louis directing and editing and helping with the writing and producing. You know, he's kind of... All of this is kind of... Yeah, it's a lot.
He's got to take the vision that Jim Henson had, continue that, and then put his own stamp on it. He's obviously developed an incredible knowledge about how the creatures work, the puppets work. He's often suggesting ways that they could make improve the puppets and improve the creatures that I find quite fascinating, considering that's not his traditional background.
He's not afraid that they're puppets, which sounds a bizarre thing. You work on many shows and things where it's a puppet, it's going to do this and it's going to be a problem. But when a character walks into a room, he and Eric, they shoot it as if it was a human actor.
If he doesn't like something, he'll tell you what he thinks it should be, and he can describe what it should be rather than, no, show me something else. It's like, no, but how about this? And his ideas are brilliant, and he has given us loads of ideas of how things could look or how they could be.
Javier Griot-Marchaud.
We're in this hybrid place where we're neither a feature nor a television show. And having somebody like Louis at the top of that, the way that he works, made it really possible for us to create freely. We knew what we could write that was going to get on screen, because we knew the guy who was going to be shooting it. He was there in the room with us, you know?
There's a certain type of director that is good with these big, big, massive projects. And he's just one of those, there's like a handful of them.
Footage of Louis operating a camera. Simon Pegg.
Louis Leterrier has made essentially 5 feature films, and they're all going to drop at once and form this expansive prequel to a film that came out 30-odd years ago. It's brilliant. It's so amazing, and it's going to blow people away, you know. Those are the risks that need to be taken. You can't, you know, if you're safe all the time, everything gets very beige.
A black and white photo of Jim Henson.
The thread that keeps it all going was Louis. And I also like to think the fact that it is Dark Crystal, the spiritual thread comes right from Jim all the way through, and Brian as well.
In his studio, Brian Froud sits at his drawing desk. Cryptic symbols are superimposed over series footage of Rian sword fighting with the general. Natalie Dormer.
I like the darkness that's embraced with the Dark Crystal. I really do. I think sometimes we can sanitize and spoon feed children and young adults a bit too much.
Something about that period in the 80s meant that there was a spate of films that were kind of tinged with darkness. Not gratuitously so, just sort of something a little dangerous and otherworldly.
I make a point of showing films to my daughter that I think that she should see. So I took her through all the Amblin movies, and we watched all the formative movies of my childhood, one of which was Dark Crystal. And she watched it, and she really liked it. It frightened the life out of her.
The alchemy of working with creatures in a story that we all knew as kids that has this amazing mythical resonance for us. The puppets can be satirical, the puppets can be emotional, the puppets can say things we never got to say to our parents, what we wish we had, or that our parents never got to say to us, but we wish they had.
I've been shocked lots of times, not just once or twice, that this is going to go out and be watched by families, because it's sometimes very dark and very disturbing and very edgy. And if it was live human beings, you might shy away from some of the things that they're doing. But then I remind myself how dark Grimm's fairy tales are, and how resilient children are, and how we overprotect them. And the power of narrative like this. But it's certainly not a gentle touch.
It's cathartic as well. The highs are high, the lows are low. I like the darkness of the original Dark Crystal, and the ethos of that has bled into our prequel.
We have a real respect for the younger audience, which is that you don't have to shield them from everything uncomfortable. You actually have to let people experience some of like these grittier aspects of the world that we live in, and maybe the world becomes a little less scary because of that.
Ted Biaselli.
One of the things that I love about fantasy worlds is the breakdown of
sort of our own world segregations.
So I love that we have this intellectual, strong female character that actually comes from a political background and yet is able, through her knowledge and her curiosity, to question it and challenge it, and is smart and strong.
I've never worked on anything where there's been so many brilliant lead female roles, and this is packed full.
This is the first studio that I've been in where we went to the meetings and we were just looking at all women.
It is feminist in so far, and I mean that in the sense of equality. It's actually scary that message is still necessary and relevant now, actually, 30 years on. You'd like to think that that would be historical, but it's not. It's still contemporary.
Each clan has its own Madra, and then there was an Al-Madra over all of them. It is a maternally driven society.
The Spriten bless the Al-Madra.
And ultimately, that's the magic of the Dark Crystal, is a group of people, all of them brought their A creative game to this thing at every level, from design, production, writing, direction. And every time you see one unit of what they created, everything implies the existence of a great universe behind it. And you get to, in your own mind, go and live in that universe for as long as you want.
We brought everything we could, the skills, the imagination, the technique, from truly, you know, astounding artists.
Taron Egerton.
95% of this production has been created in exactly the same way that Jim Henson's original film was. And that was very important to me as a fan of the original, and I think the fact that Netflix, Louis, the Hensons, everyone's been very committed to that authentic way of making series.
Peter Brook.
I think it's wonderful to revisit something that Jim did 35 years ago, which was, you know, one of the most remarkable things that he ever achieved.
And I'm so proud because I really believe it does look like the future. It looks in some cases like more than the future, because we're doing so many more locations and more clans, more different types of Gelfling. We have dozens and dozens of puppets this time around. So it's really big. And I'm happy that not only we could make it like the future, but we could make it even bigger.
And I think it's just great that my sister Lisa, you know, picked up the torch and has carried it through to the most extraordinary end point.
A black and white photo of Lisa and Jim Henson.
It's exciting to have brought puppetry to this point.
A group photo of the cast and crew of The Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance, depicting dozens of people. Credits: A Definitive Film Production. Original soundtrack, Matthew Hussey. Editing and post-production, Mark Hussey. Cinematography, Isaac Elliott Fisher. Producer, Randall Lobb. Director, Randall Lobb. Title, The Crystal Calls, Making the Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance. Netflix presents The Crystal Calls, Making the Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance. A definitive film in association with Fopop Media. Sound recordists, Manny Hussey and Mark Hussey. DIT, Mark Hussey. Spirit Guide, Adam F. Goldberg. Composer, Matthew Hussey. Interviews, Jeff Addis, Jasper Anderson, Ted Biaselli, Gavin Bouquet, Philippa Broadhurst, Peter Brook, Warwick Brownlow Pike, Dave Chapman, Stephen Christie, Helena Clark Smee, Kevin Clash, John Criswell, Alice Dinian, Natalie Dormer, Phil Eason, Taron Egerton, Damien Farrell, Brian Froud, Toby Froud, Wendy Froud, Carolina Garcia, Louise Gold, Javier Griot Marchaud, Andy Hargraves, Phil Harvey, Becky Henderson, Cheryl Henson, Lisa Henson, Cindy Holland, Jason Isaacs, Stafford Lawrence, Joe M. Lee, Vivian Lee, Louis Leterrier, Blanca Lister, Will Matthews, Finaloa McLennan, Simon Pegg, Daniel Pemberton, Rita Perugi, Cameron Richardson, Richard Roberts, Ollie Robinson, Robin Schoonrad, Joe Scott, Nick Richardson, Helena Smee, Hallie Stanford, Neil Sterenberg, Ollie Taylor, Ty Teager, Eric Wilson, Brian Wright, Victor Verid, and Julie Zabel. The Netflix definitive film Fopop Red Digital Cinema, Aperture Black Magic Design, Apple Third Eye, and Endcrawl logos appear. Copyright 2019, Netflix, US, LLC. All rights reserved. The Dark Crystal is a trademark of the Jim Henson Company. All rights reserved. Black and white footage of Jim Henson.
My own kids have always been a part of the creative process, I suppose. My oldest two daughters have always been people that I bounce a lot of things off of.
It's kind of the most exciting challenge that we've tackled so far.
And I think Jim Henson would have just been delighted by the iconography of this and how strange it is. This is such a wonderful moment as a legacy for Jim Henson's vision.
Words appear, powered by Fopop Media Incorporated. Definitive film. Copyright 2019, Netflix, US, LLC. All rights reserved.
The red letter N unfolds into a spectrum of colors.